This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
The Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Our quote for the day from Sinclair Lewis: when fascism comes to America, wrote Sinclair Lewis, it will be wrapped in the flag and carrying a cross. Interesting thought. I was last night a guest on a conservative talk show. I'll tell you a little more about that a little later on. And the host went into this long rant about how it was in the context of the SCHIP program, and how these socialists, and the socialists, of course, are atheists, and all the atheists are socialists, and there's an agenda to bring atheism to the United States and thus turn us all into socialists. And the proof of it is that Air America Radio has put an atheist radio show on the weekends. So we thought we'd find out what's going on here. Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor are with us. They are the co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation and hosts of Free Thought Radio on Air America, on Air America Radio, freethought.com, FFRF.org, the websites. Dan and Annie Laurie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very, very pleased to have you here. Is it Annie Laurie or just Annie?
It's a double name, Annie Laurie.
Okay, Annie Laurie. Okay, cool. First of all, just, you know, a quick plug for your show. I mean, you know, tell us what you guys are up to right now.
Free Thought Radio, it is going to be airing Saturdays. It's broadcast from 1 to 2, most places Eastern. But people have to check their affiliates. And
sure.
If they do not get it, we hope that listeners will ask for it, because it's the only hour in the week that is devoted to the undevoted. And we call it slightly irreverent views, news, music, and interviews. And we have a theocracy alert, and we are there to represent the 14% of the U.S. population who are not religious. And you can turn on your radio or TV 24/7 and be preached at. So we think it's very important there should be at least one alternative every week.
So, do you guys consider atheism a religion?
No, atheism's not. There's that old joke that if atheism is a religion, then baldness is a hair color. Atheism and agnosticism, by the way, freethinkers include agnostics, is simply an absence of religion. It's the lack of religion. People who, Americans who vote and pay taxes and serve in the military and sit on juries and contribute to charity without any religious impetus, simply motivated by a real love for this human race and for this planet.
Right. So I look up religion in Webster's Ninth New Collegian Dictionary, and it says it's a cause, principle, or system of beliefs held to with ardor and faith. If it's not a religion, why do you need to come on the radio and preach about it?
Well, because the religious right in this country, mainly the Christian religious right, is bombarding us. And there's this assumption that if it's religious, it must be good, and if it's not religious, just like that host you were talking to thinks that we're all evil socialists and trying to destroy America, when in fact most non-religious people in America are good moral people who have happy, productive lives, and we want to fight back. We want to say, hey, we're here too. Don't demonize us. Let's all work together to make this a better world.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, there was a prisoner. This was an inmate in the... Oh, where was it? Wisconsin prison. And the guy wanted to organize a study group. He wanted to do what you guys are doing on the radio, only in his prison. He said there's a study group for Catholics, there's a study group for Baptists, there's a study group for Mormons, there's a study group for Muslims. There should be a study group for atheists. And the church and the prison said, no, you can't do that. It's not a religion, so you can't have a study group. He took it to the Seventh Court of Appeals, and they ruled that, in fact, it was a religion. That was,
I'm
at least for the purposes of the prison.
We're in the Seventh Circuit, and I'm not sure you've got that quite right. Atheism, it cannot be a religion. It's a rejection of religion. The word "a" in front of a word simply means without.
Right, but here's what the Seventh Court said, and this is an actual quote from the appealing.
What year are
atheism
you talking about?
Is, pardon?
What year is this?
I don't have the specific reference. No,
I don't think that's quite right, but go ahead.
But they said atheism is the inmate's religion, and the group that he wanted to start was religious in nature, even though it expressly rejects a belief in a supreme being. So he had the right to have a group, just like you would have a right to have a radio show, to talk about your beliefs or your belief in not believing.
But the First Amendment gives that inmate that right.
The basis of the lawsuit, in fact.
The free exercise of religion also means the right to reject religion. You can't have freedom of religion without the freedom to dissent. Atheism is not a religion, even if a judge has some warped idea that you have to call it a religion in order to let someone express those views. The First Amendment gives you the right to assemble and reject religion, just as it gives you the right to assemble and worship.
But if you spend a lot of time, thinking about something and working on it and essentially evangelizing about it, and it has to do with a supreme being or not.
Well,
or
Tom, if you look at the 16th,
how could that not be a religion?
Definition in any dictionary, you can get that very broad use of the term religion. That
sure.
My religion is to exercise, but that doesn't, or my religion is to listen to musicals. I mean, that doesn't mean you have a faith in the supernatural. That's what's required with a typical definition of religion: is that you believe in a supreme being. There's a set of rules and sacred laws that you must follow because of that belief. And atheists reject the supernatural. We believe in the natural world. We don't have a religion, but we do have a point of view about religion.
And even if somebody wants to call it a religion, what difference does that make? We would still have the right to express our views, whatever you want to call it. We non-religious atheists and agnostics are here. So calling it a religion might be a way to try to insult us, drag us down.
Well, I think of the Unitarian Church, for example. The Unitarian Church does not acknowledge the existence of a supreme being.
That's right.
That's their official position. And yet they are a religion. They have churches.
They call themselves
spoken in many of them. Louise and I used to attend the Unitarian Church occasionally when we lived in Montpelier. It was right down the street from us. It was quite convenient.
But they're a creedless religion, and they are an exception. They're not Christian.
What's for IRS purposes. They call themselves religions so they can have the tax breaks for the IRS. We don't do that. We're an educational group. We're not a religious organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we also are terribly concerned that we need to wake up the nation, not just other non-theists, but the public, the listeners of Air America, to the very real grave danger that our country is going in a theocratic bent, that we have the potential that we could be the first country to establish a secular constitution, and we could be the first country where the people voted out. There was a poll last month by a reputable firm that found that 55% of people think that the Constitution says this is a Christian nation. There's a great pool of ignorance out there, and we think...
John McCain adding to that recently.
What?
John McCain adding to that recently.
Right. Yeah. John McCain's remarks. Yeah. If there's this din of ignorance about the secular underpinnings of our country, and we think it's terribly important that there should be one show a week that really is devoted to the separation of church and state as well.
Yeah, but there are groups out there who are religious who are promoting the separation of church and state as well. That's really a different issue from promoting the idea that there's no God. Stop believing in that, deity in the sky, or the animists. Stop believing that the natural world around you is animated with something supernatural.
Well, the Freedom from Religion Foundation works for both aims. We are a national association of freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics, and we work to keep state and church separate. And that's because people who are personally free from religion tend to be the most committed to keeping the government free from religion. We tend to be purists because it's our rights that are the first to be invaded when religion is endorsed by the government.
And we also work with religious people. Some religious people join us in our lawsuits. In fact, we've taken the lead in challenging George Bush's faith-based initiative and winning.
Yeah, well, in that regard, I would absolutely support you. I mean, speaking as a Christian, I am concerned, frankly. Jefferson and Madison had this debate, and Jefferson was a deist, and Madison was a Christian, and you could argue that Jefferson was not religious, but in any case. Jefferson was worried that if religious people got control of government, they would turn this into a theocracy. Madison thought that was a silly idea. He was worried that if the government ever started giving money to churches, that it would corrupt his beloved Christianity. And that's why his first veto was vetoing a bill to give money to churches to care for the poor. He said this is something that the government should do. They were both right.
Madison was a little closer to Jefferson's views, I think, than you're indicating, because he pointed out that the fruits of Christianity and government had been nothing but bloodshed. His memorial.
Absolutely. He did not want there to be any connection between. In fact, he was the guy who came up with the idea of, you know, the wall of separation of church and state. Well, no, it was Jefferson, wasn't it, in the letter?
Yeah, Jefferson.
But in any case, I mean, they were in concurrence with that, but they disagreed about, you know, what the outcome would be. It turns out that they were both right, and that's the scary thing, frankly, I think, for all of us. Anyhow, FFRF.org, the website, freethought.com.
And it's also at airamerica.com. We have a website.
airamerica.com as well. Dan Barker, Annie Laurie Gaylor, thank you both.
Thank you very much.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
No excuse. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, this very much brings to mind my experience of last night. As I said earlier, I was a guest on a conservative show, a radio show, and I don't even want to name the guy right now because what I'm going to say might be perceived as a slam. I really don't mean it that way, but that's why I don't want to get into who it was, because I just don't think it's germane. What I thought was interesting was I listened to the show for about a half hour before I was on and for about an hour after I was on, and I've listened to it before. And it was essentially attack the person, attack the person, attack the person, attack the person. And then, you know, I came on and the discussion was, how can we stop attacking people? And then it got into attack the person, attack the person, attack the person. And my first thought after I got off the air was, and listened for a little longer, was, you know, this is hypocritical. That this guy is all about personal attacks and at the same time protesting that personal attacks should be part of politics. And then I realized really it wasn't hypocritical at all. It had to do with worldview. That for example, conservative morality versus liberal morality. Conservative morality wants to know, what are you doing in bed and with whom are you doing it? What drugs are you taking even in the privacy of your own home, and are they legal or illegal? What have you done in the past? You know, it's all about the personal. Liberal morality is all about the public. The words of Jesus in Matthew 25 and in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7, you know, do we have hungry among us? Then we are not moral. We cannot call ourselves a moral nation when we've got over 10 million people, over 7 million children, who one day this week will not know where their next meal is coming from and will go to bed hungry. We cannot call ourselves, and Ronald Reagan back in 1964, when John Kennedy pointed this out, you know, making a joke about, well, maybe they're just on a diet. Ha ha ha. We cannot call ourselves, you know, a liberal would say, we cannot call ourselves a moral nation if there are sick among us who are not being healed. Jesus said, heal the sick. We cannot call ourselves a moral nation if there are people among us who do not have shelter, who are not being visited in prison, or who are in prison unrighteously. We cannot call ourselves, you know, and there's that fundamental cliff. You know, why does that come about? Why is it that conservative morality is so concerned about what individuals do, and liberal morality is so concerned about what society does? And I would say it's because conservatives fundamentally hold to the notion that humans are intrinsically evil, that we are flawed. Unlike everything else in nature works just fine, thank you very much. Yeah, the wolves eat the bunnies, but, you know, if they eat too many bunnies, then there won't be that many wolves, and there's always homeostasis. Nature always strives for balance. Everything is fine. Everything is natural. It's the way it's supposed to be. It's not good or evil. It's just the way it is. And that, actually, could be argued is the greatest good. But humans are different, goes the conservative story. And to some extent, the story of most of the religions, including Christianity. To some extent, that humans are flawed and evil, and therefore conservative thinking would lead to the obvious next step. Therefore, we need to protect ourselves from the evil people among us, and if we can just do like George Bush did in Texas and execute as many people as possible who are evil, or as he thinks he's doing in Iraq, and kill off as many Iraqis who are evil as possible, then ultimately, if we kill off all the evil people, everything will be fine. It'll be a paradise. Because just the good people will be left. Whereas liberals, instead of thinking that the evil comes from within people, believe that the evil comes from institutions. That we can create societies. This was the core message of the Enlightenment in the 1600s. This was the animating idea for the creation of the United States of America. This is what even the conservatives of the day, from George Washington to Alexander Hamilton to John Adams to Thomas Jefferson to John Mason to John Jay to George Mason to John Jay to George Clinton to Thomas Jefferson, what they all believed was that it was possible to create institutions, governments, that had the ability to be good and do good, and thus allow the intrinsic goodness in people to come out. Which is why George Washington referred to America as a liberal nation. I mean, this is the liberal Enlightenment. And that's the history of liberalism. And there's always been this schism in the how we view ourselves. Liberals say, no, humans are intrinsically good. But if you put them in a situation, if you toss them into a game where their choice is kill or be killed, they will kill. If you toss them into a game where their choice is make a profit and feed your family at the expense of somebody else losing out and ending up hungry, some people will do that. Many people will do that. But why do we have to create those kind of institutions and systems? Why don't we create institutions and systems where we can make profit, we can make a living, we can run businesses, and we can establish social good? That would be the liberal point of view. The conservative point of view would be, hey, you're on your own, Charlie, and the only function of government is to protect us from the evil people. In other words, police, jails, and prisons. And I'm not suggesting that one is right or wrong, although obviously I have a dog in this fight, and I think that I'm right, but it's an interesting notion. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
It's not the makeup or the way that you dress. It's not your appearance they all detest. It's not your manners. It's that you got it in the groove. Ooh, it's your attitude.
See, and this gets right to the question that Keith Olbermann has been plaintively asking. Why is it that conservatives would attack a 2-year-old kid or a 12-year-old kid and their families simply for speaking out politically? Why did they use John Kerry's essentially childhood, his young years in Vietnam, and distort them so terribly, but basically use personal smear as part of a political campaign? And you know, why is this such a normal thing? If Paul Krugman is to be believed in his new book, Conscience of a Liberal, you know, that the right-wing smear machine is really about smearing individuals rather than discussing ideas. And you could make the somewhat cynical argument that the reason why is because if they talked about ideas, they'd have to say, well, you know, the Republicans are the party of millionaires and billionaires. They're the party of big transnational corporations. They're the party of companies that don't give a damn about the United States at all. They just assume, you know, General Electric, Jack Welch, who's held up like a god, was the guy who essentially brags about inventing the idea of outsourcing back office, you know, accounting functions and things to India. that, you know, Walmart, the great scion of the conservatives and great funder, the Walmart heirs, bringing Chinese goods into the United States, one of the first to do it in a really, really big way. Although everybody seems to have forgotten that Sam Walton's original motto was made in the USA. Everything in the Walmart was made in the USA, those of you old enough to remember. But I would submit to you that it's probably not that cynical. It's probably not just a cynical thing where they're doing it because they can't talk about their real agenda because the real agenda is something that wouldn't resonate with people. I mean, that's a kind of a side benefit. I'd say that they're doing it because they actually believe that at their core, most people are evil, and therefore they have to be, you know, you got to look out for those evil people, got to whack them down. I'm going to get just a couple of quick shots on the news that's happening here today. We'll get into some of this in more detail as we go on through the program. Particularly in our second hour, we're going to be asking the question, what happens to democracy when the middle class can no longer make it? And some of the economic news of the day, in particular in the second hour. But just a quick heads up. Yesterday, the president of Turkey asked his parliament to authorize what was essentially identical to George Bush's pre-war authorization in 2002. He said, in order to conduct incursions across the Iraqi border into Iraqi Kurdistan, not to say do it, but to authorize it. And he said, I sincerely wish that this motion will never be applied. Passage of this motion does not mean an immediate incursion will follow, but we will act in the right time and under the right conditions. Well, it passed. It just passed. Mr. Mukasey is before Congress this morning. He may be our next attorney general. He may be the guy who replaces Alberto Gonzalez. And he was asked about torture, and this seems to be quite a shocker. Spencer Ackerman posting over TPM Muckraker. This was unexpected. He compared U.S. torture to the Holocaust. He said he's unaware of any inherent commander-in-chief authority to override legal restrictions on torture. This is a huge repudiation of Dick Cheney. He was asked about David Addington and John Yoo and all these guys. He says, this answer that Michael Mukasey gave, this Spencer Ackerman writing over TPM Muckraker, he says, the answer is sure to create anxiety inside the CIA, where many interrogators fear that they will be brought up on charges for carrying out interrogation methods earlier approved by the administration. Talking about the Bybee memo, the memo that authorized torture, Mukasey said it's worse than a sin, it's a mistake, and then referenced the photographs taken by U.S. troops who liberated the Nazi concentration camps in 1945 to document what he referred to as the barbarism that the U.S. opposed. And then Mukasey said, quote, they didn't do that so we could duplicate what we oppose. Torture is antithetical to what this country stands for. I'm impressed. I got to say, I was ready for Mukasey to be just another weasel. I'm impressed. I mean, it may be just one area. We'll see. But anyhow, he's testifying before Congress right now. Dennis Kucinich says, and again, this is something that you can find over at truthdig.com. You probably won't find it anywhere in the mainstream media. Dennis Kucinich has said that after, you know, assuming Bush is not impeached, which looks pretty certain, that as soon as the keys to the White House are turned over on January 20th, 2009, that the White House should, quote, hand over Bush and his administration to law enforcement officials. Just like out of that MSNBC Predator show, yeah? Throw him on the ground, put handcuffs on him. Is that, you know, apparently that's what what Dennis Kucinich is suggesting. And finally, just to wrap up yesterday, Al Gore went on the air with Norwegian broadcaster NRK yesterday and said he's not going to be running for the White House. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Wait a minute. That's the wrong number. Yeah. No, 866-303-2270. Yeah, that's our phone number. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, and AirAmerica.com to participate in our blog. And Chuck in Tennessee, you are on the air. Chuck, what's up? Chuck? I'm not hearing Chuck, Chris. Let's see if... Oh, he's not there. Okay, great. Yeah, Yuri in San Diego. Hey, Yuri.
Yeah, Mr. Hartman.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to touch a little subject about one a few minutes ago. See, my father was Russian, and he was in Siberia, and he had an experience with the atheists over there that they thought if they commit suicide, they would become God themselves.
Sort of
the
Nietzscheists, atheists. So yeah, that's an interesting one, Yuri. Thanks for sharing that. My father, I mean, I should just lay this out. My parents always took us to church. I think that's why I feel so comfortable with Christianity. I was raised in it. But I didn't know until the last 5 or 6 years of my dad's life that he never believed any of it. My father died an atheist. and you know, which is fine. I mean, it's, I felt that it was kind of sad, frankly, because he died with lacking comfort. My mother was always very strong in her faith and still is. Paul in Queens, New York. Hey, Paul.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Tom?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me?
I certainly can, Paul. What do you want to say?
I wanted to say that these people who call themselves the Christian right don't follow Jesus' example or his disciples' example or those who followed shortly thereafter.
Or his words. I agree with you.
And the point I'm trying to make is that Jesus told Pilate his kingdom was not of this world. He prayed to his father the night before he died and said that he was not of this world, his followers were not of this world, and they didn't get involved in the politics of the world.
Right, and you will note, by the way, in that prayer, Paul, you will note, back in the Sermon on the Mount, he said, don't pray in public like the hypocrites do. And nowhere in the New Testament did Jesus pray in public, except that one time. And he prefaces that prayer by saying, Father, I know you hear me, and I'm only saying this out loud for other people to hear me for their benefit.
But
in other words, he was completely consistent.
The point I'm trying to make is that Jesus didn't get involved in politics. His disciples didn't get involved in politics. Early Christians, for the first 150 years after the death of Jesus Christ, did not get involved in politics. That's what all the historians noted.
Right, there was a guy who brought him the coin and said, should I tithe? And Jesus said, whose picture's on the coin? And the guy said, Caesar's. And Jesus said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar, and unto God's what is God's. In other words, you know, these are separate things. These are very separate things. Mark in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT.
Hello,
hey, Mark.
Tom. First off, I wanted to say that you can't possibly be a liberal Christian. Haven't you been listening to the right-wing media? There's no such of a thing as a liberal Christian.
There's a lot of us out there, Mark.
Yes, there are.
And in fact, I would say Jesus was the original liberal.
I would quite agree with that. I wanted to make the point with regard to your first guest that they were so careful to define atheism as a-theism, absence of theism. And I would say, therefore, if that is the definition that we're working from, that anything from the soap opera to the Sunday football game would be a theistic time on the television, because it is time on the television that is not devoted to theism. Your thought on that?
That's actually a variation on the argument that the religious right makes, where they say, you can't preach religion in schools, but 95% of the time you're preaching anti-religion because you're teaching science and you're teaching math, and these are all things that many religions consider to be wrong, and therefore you're preaching atheism, et cetera, and therefore you should be allowing churches into schools. I mean, it's one of those roads of twisted logic. You're right, Mark. I guess I'm agreeing with you in pointing out that there's a logical fallacy within the logical fallacy that causes it to break down. It's an interesting point. Thanks for making it, Mark. Paul in Denver, Colorado, KKZN. Hey, Paul.
Hello, Tom.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, I'm just wanting to say that I'm surprised that you're a Christian. I thought you'd be more like a Buddhist or a secular humanist. I mean, I think the sooner we as individuals become not Christians, not Muslims, but just free thinkers and individual thinkers, not Democrats, not Republicans, the world will just be a better place. Thanks.
Well, I feel about you're welcome. I feel about Christianity as an institution, and you know, there isn't a singular institution of Christianity. There's the Catholic Church, which is a singular institution, and then there's a whole mess of different Protestant denominations. And then there's all the non-Protestant denominations, you know, like Mormonism, for example, which many mainstream Christians would say isn't Christianity. The Mormons would say, no, it definitely is. And you know, Seventh-day Adventists and on it goes. I mean, there's just this huge spread. And my take on Christianity, frankly, is the same as my take on the Democratic Party, which is rather than rejecting it, people of goodwill, people who if it were a non-toxic institution, would feel very comfortable there, should come together and take it over and participate in it. I think we need the participation of more progressives in Christianity and in Judaism, and I mean in the institutions of Judaism and in Islam and in the institutions of Islam, because, you know, religious institutions have, as many people point out, been responsible for the deaths of millions over the years. And the way you change that is by changing the institutions in ways that are consistent with their core and original teachings, and yet not toxic. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Apropos of one of the last callers, I just want to say, on the one hand, I have spent probably thousands of hours, certainly thousands of hours in my life, in Christian churches and involvement with Christianity and Christian churches and Christian institutions. A very, very close and intimate involvement. I have also probably spent a couple of thousand hours in my life sitting zazen and in Buddhist institutions. And where my first curiosity about the intersection of the two was one of my heroes when I was a teenager, which was Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, a Catholic, who wrote two books that were two of my absolute favorites, Zen and the Birds of Appetite and Mystics and Zen Masters. And anybody who really wants to get into this, I would just suggest you get Thomas Merton's book, Zen and the Birds of Appetite. Read the third chapter, Christian Look at Zen. And the other was a dear friend of mine and Louise's, absolutely one of our favorite, I mean, I say this without exaggeration, probably one of our 10 favorite people that we've ever known in our entire lives, Brother Wayne Teasdale. He was a Catholic priest. He taught at the Union Theological Seminary in Chicago. He was a guy who 6 months out of the year taught Catholic priests how to become Catholic priests. And then 6 months out of the year, he was a member of Father Bede's order in India. 6 months out of the year, he wore beggar's robes and traveled around India, literally homeless, foodless, literally every day begging for his food as a wandering monk. And it was Wayne Teasdale who helped organize the meeting that we had with the Dalai Lama, and he was very, very close friends with the Dalai Lama. And every day these two guys were walking around arm in arm. And Wayne died 2 years ago. He wrote a brilliant book called The Mystic Heart that I wrote a blurb for. He wrote a blurb for my book on one of my two books on Christianity called The Prophet's Way. Wayne was just incredible, and I commend you to his writings, The Mystic Heart. So anyhow, if you want to get into that kind of stuff, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Warren in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hey, Warren.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air, Warren.
Oh, wow. It cut out kind of quick there. Yeah, I'm calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Just weighing in on your question. I don't think atheism is a religion. I am an atheist. And I also wanted to...
But it has a belief system and a coherent structure to it, and there's a certain element of evangelism associated with it. How does that make it not
a
religion?
Well, go back. It's a belief system.
Right.
Did you say?
Yeah. I mean, you're asserting that there isn't a deity because you don't have any evidence of it. I'm asserting that there is, or there's something, and my evidence is entirely subjective. I believe that I've personally experienced it, but I can't, you know, show that to you or share that with you. So both of us are operating on what I would submit to you is a belief system.
Well,
doesn't that mean that we're both religious?
When you talk about the word belief, I mean, there are different qualities of it, different ways to use that word. You can talk about believing something because you have good evidence, because you can point to something.
Well, I think we both believe that the sun will come up tomorrow, and we can agree that that's science and not religion. But whether we have, you know, our relative opinions about whether or not there's something beyond what we can measure with our senses is an argument that I would make. I would suggest, you know, if you had a community of blind people who didn't know that there were people who had sight, and one among them said, you know, there's this color called red, and everybody says, no, come on, you have no, there's no objective proof of that. I mean, I think, frankly, that's where we're at in this.
I don't think saying we have relative opinions, saying I don't accept it because you have no evidence for your proposition doesn't mean it's simply an opinion, and it's not on the same level of saying I believe in the supernatural existence of supernatural beings or a pantheon of them.
But I would submit to you that But I'm fine with that. I mean, as I said, I have no problem with people being atheists. I one of the things, in fact, Jesus told me to do is not judge other people. But I would submit to you that you have no more proof for the non-existence of the divine, as broadly as we want to categorize it, than I have proof of it.
What?
Then you have no more proof against it than I have proof for it.
Well, you won't find atheists telling you they can prove there's no God, just that we don't accept the proposition and you offer no proof and we don't...
Right, right. So what we have are dueling opinions. We're dueling, and if those opinions raise to the level of affecting our lives, I'd say beliefs.
There you go again with the word opinion. It's like you're trying to yank these things onto two-level playing fields when they're not. It's not simply a matter of opinion. It's a matter of... You have a very fantastical set of beliefs that involve a whole lot of things that you claim are history, a book you claim, I'm not sure where you claim it came from, but to ask me to accept all that when...
Well, I'm not asking you to.
Well, I think
Christianity is intrinsically evangelical, I find a lot of solace and goodness in my religion, and I'm very happy with it. And if you find a lot of solace and comfort in atheism and you're happy with it, more power to you. You know, as I said, I watched this with my dad the last 6 years of his life as he was dying, as he had a terminal illness.
Yep.
And I'm not sure yet. You know, I've been chewing on this thing for a long time. He died last June, a year ago June. And I'm still trying to figure out, you know, ultimately, of course, I'll never know. But, you know, was that... I know that he struggled with it, frankly. I remember the day that he was diagnosed. He was told he was going to die. And when he was first diagnosed, they told him he had 3 to 6 months to live. He lived for another 5 years. Mm-hmm. And the minister for our church was there. And Dad immediately turned to this guy and said, "Would you pray with me?" And you know, this is the guy who a year before had been telling me, "Yeah, there's no God, you're not going to go anywhere." And then a month later, he's telling me, "There's no God, I'm not going to go anywhere. The lights are simply going to go off." But I know that he reached out for it, you know. And
it sounds like the old atheist in a foxhole kind of an argument.
I think it was, frankly. And
when somebody's in a bad position and struggling and fearful,
you take anything you can get. Yeah. No, I got it, Warren. I'm sorry we're out of time, but it's a great discussion. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, what happens when democracy takes out the middle class?
The Tom Hartmann Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. You're tuned into the Tom Hartmann Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
So what happens to democracy if the middle class can no longer make it? Welcome back to our program. There's some really startling economic news floating around, things that I frankly think you need to know about and we all need to be talking about. First of all, last week, the Nobel Prize, of course, Al Gore won the Nobel Prize, the Peace Prize, but the Nobel Prize for Economics was given out as well. Didn't get quite as much fanfare. I mean, in fact, it actually wasn't one of the original prizes that Alfred Nobel came up with. He was really, the Peace Prize was really his thing. After all, he invented dynamite. But the guy who won, or one of the guys, there are three American economists who received the Nobel Prize for Economics, and one of them was Professor Eric Maskin. And he has now spoken out on the subject of his Nobel Prize. He received the Nobel Prize for work he did on what's called mechanism design theory, which is a way of determining how trading systems work in an economy so that you can predict their behavior and hopefully control their behavior in ways that allocate resources well. Now, I realize that sounds, you know, kind of eco-speak or economy-speak. But that's what he won the Nobel Prize for. So anyhow, it has to do with basically how markets work. And as Reuters is reporting today, He has now spoken out. Professor Eric Maskin, based on his own research, this is not where, you know, somebody wins the Nobel Prize in, well, in economics and decides that they can then, you know, now that they've got a microphone in front of them, they should start talking about religion, for example. Now, this is the guy who won the Nobel Prize in economics, talking about not just economics, but about the specific area in economics for which he won the Nobel Prize, which is how the free market works. The, quote, free market, or market forces, let's say. That's how he would refer to his market forces. And this is the story. John Hertel wrote it for Reuters. Society should not rely on market forces to protect the environment or provide quality health care for all citizens. A winner of the 2007 Nobel Prize for Economics said. Professor Eric Maskin, one of three American economists to receive the award, said he, to some extent, takes issues with free market orthodoxy championed by U.S. President George W. Bush and some other Western leaders. This is that neoliberalism we talked about yesterday, the conservative economic philosophy, the Reaganism, trickle-down economics, supply-side economics. Basically, what he's saying is that's all well and good if you're simply trying to predict a bunch of profitable companies competing with each other in a relatively flattened marketplace, you know, within a country or among countries that have virtually no rules. Yeah, that's all fine. But when it comes to the commons, when it comes to the environment, when it comes to whether or not people have health care, you should never depend on market forces. Or you should not. This is what he said. Well, his actual quote, this is a 57-year-old guy who lives in a house once occupied by Albert Einstein, Professor Eric Maskin. He says, the market does not work very well when it comes to public goods. Which is what, gee, I've been saying on this program for 5 years, what I've been writing for 15 to 20 years, that there is the market, there is the private sector, and then there's the public sector. And what conservatives would have us do, or what conservative philosophy would have us do, not to pick on any individual conservatives, because I'm sure there's many among them who are of goodwill and just don't understand the implications of the philosophy that they're espousing. But what conservative philosophy would have us do is abandon, essentially, the commons to the market. Just let the millionaires and billionaires take care of everything. Other than putting people in prison, of course. And what he's saying is that, no, there is this thing, the commons, and, you know, whether it's police, whether it's fire, whether it's public education, whether it's our roads, whether it's our infrastructure, whether it's our bridges, whether it's our dams, whether it's our water systems, whether it's our septic systems, whether it's our power systems, those things that tend to be natural monopolies and that most appropriately, and I'm not quoting him now, these are my words, not his, but they reflect the perspective that he's putting forward, which is the traditional economic view of things, by the way. Those things that tend to be natural monopolies, or those things that have to do with the commons, or those things, to quote Thomas Jefferson, that have to do with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, are the province of institutions wholly beholden to we the people, rather than wholly beholden to profit. And in fact, he suggests, if you turn these institutions over to the market, it'll totally screw it all up. In its statement with the reward, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said, quote, the market's efficiency may be undermined because consumers are not perfectly informed, competition is not completely free, and privately desirable production and consumption may generate social costs as well as benefits. Excuse me. Caught a sneeze there. So, anyhow, the Nobel Prize winner in economics is coming out and saying, hey, pay attention to this stuff. In the meantime, the international business editor for The Telegraph, just hours ago reporting data from the U.S. Treasury. This must have just been reported by the U.S. Treasury. This is the first report I've seen on it, and oddly enough, it's coming from outside the United States. The headline, Japan and China lead the flight from the dollar. The subhead, fears of dollar collapse as Saudis take fright. China threatens nuclear option on dollar sales. And Ambrose Evan Pitchard, this bear is not capitulating. Okay, here's the article. Data from the U.S. Treasury showed outflows of $163 billion from all forms of U.S. investments. These numbers are absolutely stunning, said Mark Oswald, an economist at Insigur de Beaufort. Asian investors dumped $52 billion worth of U.S. Treasury bonds alone, led by Japan with $23 billion, China with $14 billion, and Taiwan with $5 billion. It is the first time since 1998 that foreigners have, on balance, sold treasuries. He says, woe betide. This is literally the quote from this economist, the head economist at this one of the European think tanks and banks. Associated with a bank, he says, woe betide U.S. treasuries if inflation does not remain benign. The International Monetary Fund yesterday warned that the dollar is still overvalued. In other words, our currency is going to continue to collapse. The international community, well, the International Monetary Fund is saying that our dollar is still overvalued, which means that we're not as rich as we think we are. And as the value of the dollar goes down, our standard of living as a nation is going to go down with it, as it has been steadily. And then they point out, perhaps the obvious, David Wu, an analyst at Barclays Capital, the British firm, says Washington was happy to see the dollar slide. Here's his quote. They see it as a way of correcting the deficit. See, this is what happened during the last 6 or 8 years of the Vietnam War. We were borrowing massively, particularly during Nixon's running the Vietnam War, although it started, frankly, under Lyndon Johnson. This is neither Democratic nor Republican, although the Republicans tend to be the ones who have elevated this to a religion. Of borrow like crazy, spend the money largely on defense and to your cronies who will cycle it back to you in the form of campaign contributions. And then let the next generation pay for it. Well, the next generation after the Vietnam War, you know, a generation being, Thomas Jefferson defined a generation as 19 years. Generally now a generation is thought of as 20 years. The next generation after the Vietnam War came in the late 1970s, and that was when the bill came due for all the debt that Richard Nixon ran up in the early 70s for the Vietnam War. And having to pay off that debt led to what? High inflation. Well, stagflation, you know, stagnant economy and high inflation. What did high inflation do? It meant that the dollar, with you got an inflation rate of 15-20%. I remember this was the first time Louise and I ever bought a house. And I remember having a mortgage that was just, it was two figures. I don't remember the exact number, 13, 14, 15%, something like that. It was incredible. I mean, that's just, you know, and that's for a 30-year fixed mortgage. What it does is it allows the government to pay off debts in dollars that are worth less than the dollars that they borrowed. That's why governments are all in favor of inflating currencies. They point out the U.S. requires $70 billion a month in capital inflows to cover its current account deficit, but the key sources of finance are drying up one by one. If the world starts to say, no more loans, U.S., and we continue down the road that Reagan and Bush have taken us, and Clinton, to a large extent, with regard to international trade. Clinton, not so much with regard to domestic policies. He actually had a surplus in the budget. But if we continue down that road, we're toast. It is really time to start waking people up and saying, you know, these guys, you know, running up the biggest debt in history, this is crazy. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
If you knew the earth was dying, if they said this on the news, if they would clarify the picture instead of seeking to confuse you. You could see the ice caps melting, if you could watch the oceans rise, you could see the consequences right before your eyes. If you knew the kids were dying, if you could look inside the river where their food comes from, filled with cyanide. If you could hear the parents pleading, if they were looking right at you, if you could see the anguish in their hearts. What if you knew?
Yeah, what if you knew? Well, we do know. 21 minutes past the hour. Al Gore, Leonardo DiCaprio waking us up. And nonetheless, the world is just full of strange people, I gotta tell you. Just some truly crazy people. As a British survey, what you would do with the last 2 minutes of your life if you knew an asteroid were on collision course with Earth. 2% of the people said they'd start looting. I don't get it. I just don't get it. Anyhow, just to wrap this stuff up, I just want to pop through some, very quickly, articles that I clipped out of this morning's Wall Street Journal and Financial Times. Just those two sources. Just the business press talking to the business press, the millionaires and billionaires talking to the millionaires and billionaires. Fred in the chat room posits the question, who benefits from the dollar's collapse? And the simple answer is transnational corporations, corporations who it doesn't matter to them whether the United States is rich or poor because they can always do business someplace else, or in fact are. I mean, more than half of General Electric's, for example, the owner of NBC and MSNBC, more than half of their and defense contractor and nuclear plants and jet engines and light bulbs and everything, more than half of their business is done outside the United States. So does it matter to them if the United States goes down the tubes? Ultimately, probably not that much, as long as there's some other market that emerges someplace else. You know, if you've got new Chinese consumers, great, let's service them. So number one, the transnational corporations benefit, particularly since it makes our labor cheaper. And number two, wealthy people who had the foresight to invest outside the United States benefit. And so, you know, people who have invested as, frankly, you know, some of our Louise and my retirement funds are invested in Canadian companies. Why? Because I don't think I 4 or 5 years ago when I made the decision to move it there, move some of our money there, it was because I didn't think that the American companies being tied to the dollar were going to hold value the way that a Canadian company, even if a Canadian company doesn't go up in value, if the Canadian dollar doubles in value, your stock doubles. So anyhow, that's who benefits. So here, this is the headline from the front page. This is the screaming front page headline in today's Financial Times, the British version of the Wall Street Journal, the Daily. Investors flee U.S. securities. Foreign investors, this is by Michael McKenzie in New York, foreign investors slashed their holdings of U.S. securities by a record amount. Now, this is U.S. securities. Not only are these foreign governments, as I shared with you in the last story, dumping treasury bills, in other words, our debt instruments, the way that we borrow money, they're now dumping stocks. Securities is a fancy word for stocks. Foreign investors slashed their holdings of U.S. securities by a record, well, by and large. They need equities, actually, as stocks, but. Yeah, in fact, let me correct myself. Securities are not necessarily stocks. They can be debt instruments as well. Foreign investors slashed their holdings of U.S. securities by a record amount as the credit squeeze intensified, according to the latest Treasury figures. The Treasury International Capital Report, known as the TIC, for August, will be closely watched because it appears amid growing concern about the weakness of the U.S. dollar. Alan Ruskin, chief international strategist at RBS Greenwich Capital, says there is no way to get away from the lack of corporate bond inflows, the foreign selling of U.S. equities, and the countervailing strong U.S. purchases of foreign equities and bonds. In other words, investors in the United States are putting their money outside the United States, as unfortunate as that is, and companies from outside the United States are not loaning us money anymore by borrowing our debt instruments. And they're not loaning our corporations money anymore by buying their bonds, by buying their debt instruments. Now, some analysts are suggesting that this August data might be an aberration. Again, quoting Michael McKenzie in today's Financial Times, since it occurred during the most intense period of this summer's credit squeeze. However, he adds, others suggest that the scale of swing in August indicated the more fundamental pressures are now bubbling. And to that point, in the Wall Street Journal, we've got Henry Paulson, our Treasury Secretary, our multi-hundred millionaire Treasury Secretary, calls for an aggressive response to the U.S. housing slump, saying the decline in related problem in credit and mortgage markets were, quote, the most significant current risk to our economy. He says it's starting to have a real impact on our economy. The fact that annual housing starts have now fallen off more than 40% since early 2006. The last paragraph of this article by Damian Paletta in today's Wall Street Journal, the Bush administration has historically favored market discipline as a major motivating force. But Mr. Paulson said that an enhanced regulatory role was likely necessary to prevent problems from recurring. The Republicans are starting to talk like Democrats, because they are realizing that their Republican strategies don't work. Just like the guy who won the Nobel Prize for Economics said they wouldn't work. And in fact, again, back to the Financial Times, another article today on page 3 of the Financial Times, doubling of foreclosures signals continuation of mortgage crisis. I'm sorry, this is from last week's Financial Times. I cut it out. This is the first chance to get to it. U.S. home foreclosures last month were double those of a year ago, and the nation's biggest mortgage lender said late payments rose, suggesting the U.S. mortgage crisis is not abating. In the meantime, this from today's Financial Times, Bear Stearns, you know, the big bank investment firm Bear Stearns. Guess who's talking about buying it? China! At the same time, China is definitely not becoming democratic. That from today's Wall Street Journal. I'll share that with you after the break. We'll take your calls. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour, and by the way, we do get mail here.
You know it's nice when the postman has a letter in a sack for you.
Well, this is actual physical mail.
The mail must go through. The mail must go through.
Linda writes, no dear Tom, hello. I've tried everything I could to email you, and still, for the life of me, cannot figure it out. She says, you're so brilliant. I'd love to know what your IQ is. You stimulate my brain, and yes, if Louise ever wants to let you go, I'm available. No. No, I really respect how you openly love your wife. And by the way, we share the same birthday. Okay, she goes on to say, I, too, live in Boulder County, and I also work for Comcast. And it's not like me to stick up for the company I work for, especially a big corporation, but knowing you like all the facts, a couple of months ago, Comcast did move MSNBC. This is my rant about how here in Portland, Comcast is going to charge me an extra buck a month for MSNBC to watch Keith Olbermann. And she says, a couple of months ago, Comcast did move MSNBC from analog to digital along with C-SPAN. You were right on that. But the way I understood it was that these stations wanted to go digital. And so presumably once you go digital, then you become in the category of you've got to have a special box to get it, and it costs an extra buck because it's part of the digital package. As a way of kind of boiling it down. And she says, and Comcast tried to soften the blow by, you know, making the first 3 months or 6 months free and giving us, you know, starter package, free box, and all these kind of things. She says, I hope this clarifies your question as to why it was changed. Hate to see Comcast get a bad rap for something they could not prevent. Well, if that's the case, thank you for Linda for setting me straight. And I don't know. We will find out, won't we? We will find out. You know, on the other hand, could it be that, you know, a big corporation is using their power as a big corporation, as a natural monopoly, to increase their profits?
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
Yes, it would be shocking. You tell them, Claude. Okay. Communists move to adapt their rule to a richer China. The front page of today's Wall Street Journal. China, Dateline Beijing. Andrew Bateson and Jason Dean writing, China is the only one of the world's 10 largest economies that isn't a multi-party democracy. As the Chinese Communist Party gathers this week for a key meeting, the leadership is fine-tuning its role to make sure things stay that way. They point out that only about 24 people run the entire country. A country, by the way, that for the last 15 years has been growing at an annual rate of around 10%, now is growing this year at a rate of around 12-13%. This is explosive. Over 100 billionaires now in China. There was maybe one 30 years ago. Last time I was in China was in 1986. I wrote a chapter about it in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And, boy, has it changed. I've been in Hong Kong a few times since then, but not mainland China. Beijing specifically, and amazing. This and now they're looking at buying a piece of Bear Stearns. Just a couple of other quick headlines, and then we'll take your calls. Debt glut threatens growth. This in today's Financial Times. Now here's the problem: we have a fractional banking system in the United States with the Federal Reserve System. What that means is the way that money gets created is it gets lent into existence. Let's say that there's an absolute fixed amount of money in the United States and no banks are loaning any money to anybody, so we have an absolute fixed number of dollars, just for purposes of explanation. And I go to my bank and I say, I'd like to borrow $1,000. And they say, okay, fine, here's $1,000. Now, where do they get that $1,000 from? They have to have on deposit a certain threshold amount. I believe it's 10%. So they've got $100 deposited by, say, David, my producer. The other 900, they just create out of nowhere. And what that does is what that and so now I've got $1,000, and so I go to another bank and I deposit that $1,000 and start spending it on, say, a business that I'm doing or something like that. And now that other bank has $1,000, so they can now loan $100,000. And boom, money starts getting created. So as long as there's this increase, this steady increase, debt creating cash, creating debt, the money supply is expanding continuously. And as long as the money supply is expanding at the same speed that the economy is expanding, everything's fine. If the money supply is expanding faster than the economy is expanding, then you have what's called inflation. And if the money supply is expanding slower than the economy is expanding, you have what's called the Great Depression. And the concern right now, remember that carefully, that's called deflation. So in other words, if banks can no longer borrow from each other or engage in lending because they don't have the reserves to lend from, they can't help manufacture money. So we go into a deflationary spiral. This article in today's Financial Times was the one that really made my blood run cold. The headline, Debt Glut Threatens Growth. Banks take $280 billion onto balance sheets. Federal Reserve shows net assets down $40 billion. Those are the headlines. Big U.S. commercial banks have seen $280 billion of new debt come onto their balance sheets since the credit squeeze, threatening to undermine economic growth by inhibiting their ability to make new loans. In other words, instead of new assets coming onto the bank's balance sheets that they can then loan out against, they have debt, which means that they can't even loan at the zero rate. They have to cut back on the amount of lending they're doing. You cut back on the amount of lending you're doing, you decrease the money supply of the nation. Large bank capital represented by net assets has declined by $40 billion since the beginning of August. This is rather serious because such a steep and sudden compression in large bank capital has the potential to create a negative lending environment, says David Rosenberg, the economist at Merrill Lynch. Now, that's all economists speak for. This is the kind of thing that creates what is known in history as the Great Depression, as deflation. And it could be a disaster. And again, it all tracks back to Ronald Reagan in 1981 saying that, yes, he would borrow, and he did. More money than every president from George Washington to Ronald Reagan, more money than every president in history combined, and pass off much of that money, a good chunk of it, at least a third of it, to his buddies in the defense industry, and slightly stimulate the economy thereby and say, see, times are great. And this year, you and I are paying $160 billion in interest just on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed. And then George W. Bush comes along and borrows even more money than Ronald Reagan did. If you can imagine. Anyhow, 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. A lot on the table from Al Gore saying he's not running. Who believes it? Who doesn't? To is atheism a religion? to the story, the news of the day. There's a story about General Sanchez I want to share with you. He's apparently attacking Fox News. We'll get to that in a little bit as well. Mark in San Francisco, listening on K-Green, KGRN. Hey, Mark, what's up?
How's it going?
Hey, just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I wanted to talk about the fact that I think John Edwards is a great candidate. I know that everybody's up for Gore, and he's good, but I think we have a good man in Edwards. And what you're talking about with the destruction of our economy by the Republican Party, basically, to me, it's treason against its own people. He's one of the guys that can fix the problem.
Oh, I know. He has been talking about this for a decade, John Edwards has. This is his signature issue. And by the way, another story, and thanks for bringing it up, Mark, and another story that about John Edwards that you won't hear in the mainstream media because the mainstream media has decided that they're not going to report basically on anything that has to do with John Edwards because he's the one that the Republicans are the most afraid of, and he's the one that the corporations, big transnational corporations who own the mainstream media are the most afraid of. Not only, this is from the caucus, the New York Times blogs. Not only did John Edwards receive the endorsement today of the Iowa State chapter of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, he also garnered the backing of 9 other state chapters of the SEIU, including the biggest prize of all, the SEIU Council in California, which represents 650,000 workers. This means that over 1 million union workers in SEIU, more than half of its national membership, have officially endorsed John Edwards. And SEIU is considered broadly the most politically active of all the unions. More than half of their members have now endorsed John Edwards. It should tell you something. Dave in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom, how are you? This seems a little esoteric after all that great news about our economy here, but I just wanted to argue that atheism is not a religion. I mean, the fundamental difference is that religious belief is an irrational choice. It says that there are things out in the world that I can never know, and that
but
the
I
world...
But I say atheism is irrational. I would agree with you if you were saying agnosticism, because agnostics say, I don't know. But an atheist says, I know it's not there. And that's like a blind person saying, I know there's no such thing as color. Come on, don't. You're trying to fool me here.
No, it's not the same as saying it's not there.
Just because you can't sense it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
No, it's saying that I believe the world is knowable. I can know why the world is what it is. I can use science and observation to tell me why the world is as it is. I may not currently understand it, but through science and my research, I can eventually get to know it.
Right, and see,
religious belief,
that
on the other hand, is irrational because it says there are parts of this world that I can never know, that are unknowable, yet I just have to have faith in that. That's
well,
the difference.
Let me go halfway with you, Dave. There are parts of religion that are irrational belief. There are parts of religion that I believe are rational beliefs in that they are grounded in personal experience.
Those parts would overlap with the atheist belief. Yes, belief in humanistic values, belief in helping our fellow man, the common good, those things are not outside the realm of atheism. But in the core of all religion is an irrational belief in an unknowable deity.
And I would say the same is true. That same irrational belief is at the core of atheism. It's like you can't see radio waves, and if there were no radio receivers around for you to listen to the radio, you'd say, there's
radio
no such thing as radio waves.
Science tells us, Tom, and that's
but
the irrationality
of
it.
In 1700, you didn't know that.
What?
Right? For a long time, we didn't know that.
Just because we don't know them doesn't mean they're not knowable.
Okay, well, I'm suggesting then that religion is ultimately knowable as well. How's that?
No, then it's no longer religion.
Okay, Dave, thanks a lot. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
And this is what I like about Japan. Let me just toss this. This is my last economic story here, just a sentence or so. This, again, from today's Financial Times by Mariko Sanchanta in Tokyo. The Japan's Fair Trade Commission has unveiled proposed changes to anti-monopoly laws that would broaden the definition of anti-competitive behavior and increase fines. In other words, Japan is starting to crack down. Remember the debate we had, I think it was yesterday, maybe it was the day before, with one of the folks from Ayn Rand about monopolies and the antitrust legislation, and I was saying it's good, and he's saying, no, it's bad. Well, Japan is saying, enough already. Big corporations wiping out small competitors, wiping out, preventing people from getting into the marketplace. Not a good thing. We're going to adopt stronger anti-monopoly laws. If only in the United States we would begin to enforce the ones we have, the ones that Ronald Reagan suspended the enforcement of in 1981, leading to the mergers and acquisition mania and the mess that we have now. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us from Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. President says he's sprinting to the finish. He's sprinting to the finish.
To the finish. Now, this is the finish that it happens 460 days, 11 hours, 2 minutes, and 14 seconds from now?
That would be that day, yes.
The day that somebody else puts their hand on the Bible. Did you see where Dennis Kucinich said that right after the new president puts his or her hand on the Bible and takes the oath of office, they should immediately take the Bush administration into custody?
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, they should be turned over to authorities and held to account for their crimes. That's not a verbatim quote, but the turned over to authorities part is verbatim. Yeah.
Well, with the amount of power that the unitary executive now has, I would imagine that you could do that and have no repercussions whatsoever.
Send them to Guantanamo. There's a precedent for it.
Exactly. There's a precedent for just about anything now.
Yeah, render him to... Oh, geez, I can see this now on the right-wing blogs. Hartman says, render Bush to Egypt. No. But,
no.
Oh, my.
No.
But I do think that there is accountability. It's a very real thing. And if you have an administration that has broken the law, they should be held accountable for it. I think that the biggest mistake Gerry Ford made was pardoning Richard Nixon, because we never had a national closure on that, and it empowered future presidents to break the law, believing that the precedent had been established, just like when George Washington decided not to run for a third term, and that established the precedent of running for two terms, and then, you know, rolling it over, the precedent has been established that if you commit crimes while in office, you will be forgiven on the way out. Or if at the very worst, if you get impeached, you'll be forgiven on the way out. And I think that that's a shame. I think that's wrong.
It does seem to have been established that way. Maybe there's a crime that would be so heinous that you would not be forgiven, but I can't imagine what it would be.
Like creating 4.5 million refugees in the Middle East and causing the death of 800,000 Iraqis and 3,800 U.S. soldiers and the maiming and disfigurement of over 30 or 40,000 U.S. soldiers and...
No, I'm talking about something serious, Tom.
Oh, you mean like having sex in the White House?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, I see. Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So Bush is sprinting to the finish line.
Sprinting to the finish. He also says that Congress isn't doing anything. They haven't sent him a single appropriations bill. And one thing Congress should not be doing is sorting out the historical record of the Ottoman Empire, he says.
Well, I agree with him on that, actually.
Right. That's one thing they should not be doing.
This resolution condemning the Armenian massacre, the Armenian massacre is a real historical fact, and I don't think pretty much anybody denies it. And it was an attempt by genocide by the Ottoman Empire. But you know, it was 1915. I mean, we can acknowledge it in our history books. Congress doesn't have to slap the Turks in the face at the exact same time that they've got 60,000 troops massed on their border with Iraq, you know, Iraqi Kurdistan, and they just their parliament just today voted yes to give the president the authority to attack Iraq. Turkey.
You know, it does speak to what a different time it was, just as recently as the 90s, when President Clinton said to Speaker Hastert, "Look, could you just take this off the table and not do it?" And the Speaker said, "Yeah, all right."
Yeah,
and he took it off the table.
And it wasn't because it was all the same party. It was because it was all reasonable people.
Right.
Because Bill Clinton was a Democrat and Hastert was a Republican.
Right, exactly.
Not to say that Denny Hastert was always reasonable, but by and large, I mean, compared to what we're seeing nowadays, I mean, it's just incredible.
There was a level of reasonableness. President Bush also warned other world leaders that he says, I've told people that if you're interested in avoiding World War III, it seems like you ought to be interested in preventing Iran from having the knowledge necessary to make a nuclear weapon. So he's actively talking now about World War III.
Whoa. He said it would be incumbent on us to prevent Iran from having the knowledge to make a nuclear weapon. In other words, he doesn't want them to have access to the Internet.
He said to prevent them from having the knowledge necessary to make a nuclear weapon.
This was one of the arguments that he did with Saddam. You know, when he first said Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, then it was demonstrated that they didn't. He said they had the knowledge to make nuclear weapons, and that justified it. There is not a high school kid in the world who can't get the knowledge to make a nuclear weapon right now.
That's right. It's all over the Internet.
And so
maybe he's going to close it down.
Oh, man. I mean, when he starts generalizing like that in order to justify a war, I get seriously concerned. I really think that this is part of a partisan strategy that the Republicans want some Republicans, not probably all of them, maybe not even most of them, but some Republicans want there to be a strike on Iran. They're willing to gamble that it won't lead to World War III, that it will, however, you know, make Bush look tough and make the Republicans look tough, and that it will accrue a partisan advantage to the Republicans in the election in 2008, and that therefore it'll probably happen in the summer or fall of 2008 would be my guess. But you know, who knows? I mean, with this guy, who knows?
You can't. It's impossible to tell. Yeah. It's absolutely impossible to tell. Meantime, before the Senate Judiciary Committee, we have Mukasey, Michael B. Mukasey, up to be the head of the Justice Department and making headway. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, he's calling out torture. Now, if he'll back it up if he'll back up his words with deeds, like producing some documents or making some pledges, some absolute promises to behave himself well, you know, maybe, you know, we all believe in redemption, I think. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't want to know what you don't know. Sometimes even what you do know isn't exactly what's right.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be that everything you know about where our food comes from is wrong? Ann Velizis is here to correct that illiteracy about what's in the kitchen. Her new book, Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back, is out now in the bookstores. And Ann is in the studio with us. Hey, Ann, welcome.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. You talk about in your book, it's actually a historical text in many regards, although it's also very contemporary, going back to the 1800s, you know, this whole concept of the debate about canned and prepared foods and, oh, my God, somebody's going to put something in a can. And tell us about this.
Well, what I thought was really fascinating, Tom, when I went back to look at this question historically, is that in pre-industrial America, people really expected to know about their foods in kind of a first-hand sensory way. They wanted to know, they expected to know specifics about the places and particulars of where their food came from. But then when the food system industrialized, of course, how foods were made became pretty unappetizing. And so people were skeptical about these changes. You know, canned foods, as nowadays we think of them as entirely familiar, but back then they were kind of like revolutionaries. People were very suspicious of canned foods.
Well, it wasn't just back then. Louise, my wife, when she was growing up, her family, her mother was just, she would not serve canned food.
Yeah, well, if you think about it,
her grandmother would not have it in the farm.
Right. People, you know, if you think about it for perspective, before cans, foods were leafy, green, fleshy. They were, you know, something you could hold and smell and evaluate with your senses. But then cans kind of hid what was inside them. And so that led to, of course, new ways of having to know foods. And just at the time these changes were happening, a brand new advertising industry basically arose to prominence by easing Americans into new ways of thinking about foods that were more palatable.
Mm-hmm. For example?
Well, for example, one of the things that early advertising did was to denigrate the old-fashioned ways of doing things, and specifically to try to make new foods seem, you know, modern and scientific, and make that criteria be the thing that was most important. One of my favorite ads from that era is for a can of baked beans that shows two scientists in white lab coats and test tubes and flasks. And the copy says, you know, something like, these fellows spent 4 years and $100,000 to perfect a recipe that no homemaker could hope to emulate. And
would this have been from the 50s?
That was actually from the 20s.
From the 20s?
Yeah. And so
wow.
One of the things I show in my book is that this, our modern food sensibility really came about in cities as in the 20s, and then kind of spread throughout the rest of the culture.
Right, because it was more difficult to transport and store fresh food into the cities, so
yeah.
Canned food was a profitable and viable alternative.
Yeah.
Interesting. Where is our food illiteracy problematic now in the United States? I mean, we hear about this epidemic of obesity and all the secondary diseases associated with it, an epidemic of malnutrition, even among people who seem to be, you know, big.
Well, I think one of the key things that has happened is we've allowed the food industry to define what food is, and maybe we've forgotten to really understand what it is.
Hmm.
You know, so food is now to us things that you buy in packages.
So Twinkies are food.
Twinkies, you know, Oscar Mayer Lunchables, the things that are quick and easy are the things that we think of as food. But, of course, over the past 20 years, this, as you pointed out, there's this huge epidemic of obesity, because what's happening is people are eating things that they've kind of have thought of as foods, as that are being presented to them as foods. But in fact, there's more and more things like corn syrup in them, more high calorie.
Which never existed before the 1980s or 1970s.
And so there's things like this that aren't as good for us, or that aren't good for us. And people aren't even aware that their diet is changing, even though they're eating kinds of the same things.
It's sort of like, you know, we're an evolutionarily designed machine for a particular type of fuel. And we haven't redesigned the machine, but we've changed the fuel. It's like if you started putting, you know, progressively more and more diesel fuel into the mix of gasoline in a gasoline car, at first that you'd notice that it's not running quite as well. You know, when you get 5% diesel fuel and you get up to 10% diesel fuel, and, well, it's really kind of knocking a lot. And you get 15% diesel fuel, and I'm seeing losing power here. And then you hit, at some point, you hit some kind of critical threshold, you know, 30, 50, 70% diesel fuel, and the car just won't start. And we're seeing now these epidemics of cancer, these we mentioned obesity, all these other physical and psychological, many would argue, ailments, the, you know, from autism to attention deficit disorder and whatnot.
Right, there's a lot we just don't know.
That all seem to track, epidemiologically, all seem to track these transformations of our food.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right on with that, Tom. And the other thing that I think is also very important is that as our consciousness, you know, if we think about America's consciousness in this larger way, has gone towards thinking about foods in relation to kind of how they make us feel, sort of the sentimental and emotional things.
Mm.
We've lost track of, you know, where of the physical context of foods. For example, what's happening also on farms, the fact that factory farms are polluting rivers, the fact that, you know, that farm workers' conditions aren't that great, that herbicides are contaminating drinking water, all these things that are the physical context of agriculture we don't pay attention to anymore either. So there's both health and environmental things that we need to pay attention to and that we haven't.
And the how we feel from food is more than just aesthetic. I mean, there are foods that contain drugs. For example, chocolate has theobromines and caffeine and other you know, the whole spectrum of actually psychoactive drugs in chocolate. Andrew Weil wrote a book about that back in the 60s that's very hard to find now. He doesn't quite want to acknowledge that he ever wrote it because it's a celebration of psychoactive drugs. It's called From Chocolate to Morphine, I think was the title.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got some foods that, because of the levels of fats in them or the levels of sugars in them, cause a particular physiological response that has an associated psychological or emotional component. People eat a lot of sugar or a lot of fat, and they feel sleepy or they feel drowsy. Some people like that. Some people crave that. And some people use that to get to sleep at night. And the consequence is that they get a little bit bigger every day.
Yeah.
So how do we, what's the call for action to you? We're talking with Ann Velises, her book, Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. What's the call for action of the book, Ann?
Well, I think the thing that is really exciting that's happening right now, Tom, is that more and more people are asking this question, and the answer is that they're finding ways to take action in their personal lives. Demand for organic foods has risen 20% per year over the past decade. Farmers markets are popping up everywhere across America, and I think people are finding that it's reassuring and satisfying to make their food chains smaller, to find foods that have real stories that they can understand and know. And if you're buying foods at farmers markets, you're going to find that they're fresher, they taste better, they get people excited about really cooking. And I think that leads to the consequence of better health for people, eating more fruits and vegetables. So I think that's one of the things that's most exciting. And that has impacts on our communities and our land, too, because if we're supporting local agriculture and places close to where we live, you know, that kind of gets rid of the middlemen, so to speak, and you know, it's a new kind of democracy, I would say.
You know, in the 40s during World War II, there were these things called victory gardens,
and
Roosevelt was out there saying, you know, why grow grass in your front yard or your backyard when you can grow vegetables?
Right.
And of course, the reason why was because then we could take our farm output and ship it off to the soldiers, and we could feed our soldiers. And I lived in Germany for a year, 86, 87. And in a small town out in the middle of nowhere called Stadtsteinach. And I would guess somewhere between half and two-thirds of every house in that town didn't have a front yard. They had a front garden. Yeah. And their backyard was a garden. And they grew somewhere between 10 and 30% of probably everything they ate all year. I mean, it's amazing how much food you can produce on a quarter acre or a half acre of land.
Yeah.
And yet there are communities in the United States, I'd say probably the majority of communities in the United States, or at least of suburban communities, where if you tried to turn your front yard into a garden, you'd have your neighbors complain. We did in Michigan once, and we actually had the county come in and say, we're going to mow this thing if you don't.
Especially if you tried to have some chickens in your yard.
Right, yeah. So how do we bring back the idea of victory gardens? How do we relocalize even right to the point of my family, this my house?
Well, I think we're starting to have a dialogue about this right now, and I mean that food security really has to happen in our heads and in our communities. And so I think we're starting to have that right now with people's greater interest in local foods and people's growing interest in gardening. Yeah. And so I think it's very exciting.
Yeah, it definitely seems like some, you know, a direction that we should be going for a whole variety of reasons, from dietary to national security. I mean, literally from dietary to national
security.
Exactly. It's kind of getting off the oil treadmill, which is part of the whole farm industrial complex.
Exactly.
And remarkable. Well, it's a great work that you've done here. Ann Velises, her book is Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. Ann, thanks for dropping by the studio.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thanks so much for being here. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott with VA Watchdog coming up next. What's going on with our Veterans Administration? Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. What's going on with our Veterans Administration? Our weekly check into what's going on, how we can support our veterans in real and meaningful ways. Larry Scott, the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Larry, welcome to the program.
Tom, good to be with you again. Thanks.
What's at the top of your radar screen today, Larry?
Well, the top of the radar screen is yesterday. We had talked about this over the past few months. The Dole-Shalala Commission, former Senator Bob Dole, former Secretary Donna Shalala, were appointed by the White House some months ago to look into the problems veterans are having, especially Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, with their treatment, their health care, their disability benefits, and what we call the transition, those who are no longer in the military, transitioning from the military health care system to the VA health care system. And they met with the president yesterday. Their report came out a few weeks ago. The president promised action, and I'm afraid we're going to get action. I'll tell you why I say I'm afraid. Back in April, we talked about this. The Dole-Shalala Commission held their first meeting on April 13th. Their report on how to solve all the problems of all the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans was due in 10 weeks. Now, at that time, I suggested, because it had been floating around Washington, that the Dole-Shalala Commission was basically a sham, that there was a done deal, there was a political agenda that was going to be handed to them, and when their report was put out, here's the agenda from the White House, and you do it. And that's exactly what we have, I'm afraid. We have, I guess the best way to say this is, do it wrong quickly, which is exactly what they've done. And now we have a bunch of recommendations. The White House is forwarding legislation to the Senate today, and we have a very interesting package of changes they want done in the system, some very, very bad changes that are wrapped in some very good things. Let me outline just briefly. They want to increase treatment for PTSD. That's good. They want more help for families of transitioning troops. This is also good. But buried in there, when we get in and start reading the fine print, is a plan to completely overhaul the Veterans Disability Compensation Program and turn it into something that will not serve veterans either today or in years to come.
How and why?
Well, here's what they're doing. They have a number of propositions. We're going to have to read the fine print of the legislation, but from the fact sheet that was issued yesterday, they want two different levels of payments and benefits for combat-related injuries and non-combat-related injuries. An example would be a troop in combat takes a bullet in the leg, the bone is shattered beyond repair, and he loses his leg. You take another guy who's back at base camp working on his Humvee and the transmission falls out, crushes his leg, it can't be repaired, he loses his leg. The one wounded in combat would get more benefits, better treatment, and higher compensation for his disability. What they're saying is a combat wound is worth more than a non-combat injury. Another thing they're saying is they want payments based on rank and time in service. What they're telling us here is a sergeant's leg is worth more than a private's leg.
And this is all consistent with their kind of corporatist worldview. I mean, it's not at all inconsistent with the way that most conservatives view
humans and you're
the
basically your sergeant's leg is worth more than your private's leg,
and your general's leg is worth the most. You know, just like the CEO is worth the most.
They're talking about additional payments for quality of life issues. Now, why that might sound good. These quality of life issues and the disabilities will be reevaluated every 3 years. This opens up a door that is extremely dangerous because a young man could have this, lose a leg, get a prosthetic device, and 3 years later they say, well, hey, you got your prosthesis, you're rehabilitated, your quality of life is now excellent, and you don't have a disability anymore. This has never been done before. They're creating or trying to create two-tiered compensation and a two-tiered disability system.
You know, it's sort of the same kind of thing that they try to do with Social Security, which is by means testing it, which is basically converted into a welfare program because there's not a broad constituency for support of welfare programs.
Right.
And so it's easier to get rid of them down the road once you've converted them into a means-tested program.
And this is exactly what it would be. It would be a means test every 3 years for a disabled veteran. And they would have to go in for this means test. And since you mentioned Social Security, here's the big kicker. The majority of the benefits being offered under this new plan would disappear at age 65 because they would be offset by Social Security retirement income.
So the fact that you've reached 65 means that you're not having a leg anymore doesn't matter, your post-traumatic stress disorder doesn't matter, or the psychological therapy that you continue to need or medications you take, none of that matters.
It doesn't matter. And what's really interesting here is your major veteran service organizations, the big ones, all of the names we mention all the time, are really in turmoil about this. They're watching
VA,
very
VFW.
Carefully.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I'm betting this is going to become partisan, unfortunately, tragically.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, you can read all about it over at VAWatchdog.org, one of the finest vet sites out there. Larry Scott, with the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Tom, thank you very much.
27 minutes past the hour. Phone number 866-303-2270. Be picking up your calls right after this break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, sort of. Broadcasting from the depths of, it's not outer space. It's the People's Republic of Little Beirut here, as George Bush Sr. liked to call Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast. And time now for a veto alert.
You're a monster, Mr. Grinch. Your heart's an empty hole. Your brain is full of spiders. You've got garlic in your soul, Mr. Grinch. I wouldn't touch you with a 39 and a half foot pole.
So, Mr. Bush, why are you vetoing this children's health insurance program? I mean, I could understand if there's some good ideological basis, a disagreement about facts. You think it's not a good thing to tax the tobacco companies to pay for health insurance for kids. You could actually make some pretty reasonable arguments. So why are you vetoing this program?
That's why the president has a veto. Sometimes the legislative branch wants to go on without the president, pass pieces of legislation, and the president then can use the veto to make sure he's a part of the process. I fully intend to do. I want to make sure. And that's why when I tell you I'm going to sprint to the finish and finish this job strong, that's one way to ensure that I am relevant. It's one way to ensure that I'm in the process, and I intend to use the veto.
So he's doing it to ensure that he's relevant. I'm enlightened. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ben in San Diego, California. Hey, Ben. You're on the air, Ben. What's up?
Hi, Tom.
Yeah. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to correct some misinformation that you broadcast about an hour and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only because I respect you so much that I'm doing this. But you said that Al Gore, I can't quote you, indicated he was not running for president.
I was quoting a BBC story.
Network.
Right.
And,
I was quoting a BBC story.
Let me read you what he really said. His position has not changed one iota over the last 8 months, as far as I know it. I'm reading from the Independent UK. And it goes, I'll read just first two sentences. Former U.S. Vice President Al Gore said today that winning the Nobel Peace Prize has not made him want to enter the 2008 presidential race. Mr. Gore told Norwegian state broadcaster NRK, "I don't have plans to be a candidate again, so I don't really see it in that context at all." And that's
So in other words, he has not totally ruled it out, just like he hasn't ruled it in.
Same language.
Yeah.
I don't have plans to be a candidate again.
You're right. He's still on the fence. Ben, thank you very much for the clarification.
I think your research may have just fed you the headlines from two other British newspapers that got it wrong.
Yeah.
But if you look at your Associated Press ticker, this is an Associated Press article in The Independent. So you can confirm
I was running off the I was running off the BB.
Can I get you to plug something? I'm a part of the California campaign to put Al Gore on the ballot. And this isn't getting much play, but we and 12 other states are, in fact, actively working to put him on our state ballots for the presidential primary.
Whether he wants you to or not.
Well, you know, he can always say no. But we're
right.
putting him on the ballot. We're organized in all 53.
Yeah, he has not given the General Sherman's speech yet. He has not given the General Sherman speech. He has not said, you know,
I have no plans, which can change tomorrow, of course.
Right. So you have a website then, presumably. You want to
CaliforniaForGore.org.
Is that F-O-R Gore?
The number four. Gore.org. Actually, if you put in CaliforniaForGore.org, either way, it'll get there.
Okay, great. Ben, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it, and thanks for the heads up. That's great. Albert in Chicago, Illinois, on the line. Hey, Albert, thanks for sitting on hold for a while there. What's up?
No problem, Tom. I was just remember when you were talking about can democracy survive without the middle class, right?
Yeah, that was the question of the second hour.
That's when I kind of made the phone
call. When you called, I know.
No big deal. And my personal opinion, I believe you probably share the same thought on it, is well, no, because if the population is just scrabbling around the food from day to day and getting enough money to get to work, much less that there is work to get to, I don't think politics and why that situation has arose would be the number one thing that would make people worry about who's in charge. It's just, hey, I got to feed this kid this month.
Absolutely.
Like that. And I think a caveat to that would be it's already kind of happening. I graduated high school in 86. Back in the 80s, there still was a civics/type of history education. I mean, there was education, but you could go – there was actually some kind of basic music class, and if you wanted to play football, it was like $30 a semester. You go to some of these high schools now, like in Illinois, it's all on the property tax basis. It's $300 to play football for your kid and to pay I'm not saying there is no middle class, but things have really changed since 86. What is that, less than 20 years ago or 20 years ago?
Yeah. Well, it was 81 when Reagan essentially declared war on the middle class and started deconstructing the New Deal and going after everything that Franklin Roosevelt did to build a great and powerful industrial democracy and with emphasizing both those words. And they've had quite a bit of success in the last 26 years.
Education. I know a history teacher in the Gary Public School System in Indiana, and he says, history's his thing. The only thing that history is anymore is dates and places. There's no reason why was this country formed? This country was formed as a separation from church and state because they came from Europe where it used to be nothing but Catholicism. Then you had the Protestantism. Then you had the English who went their Anglican ways to get away from the Catholicism. They came here to say, you know what? I don't care what you are, Quaker, Protestant, Lutheran.
Well, some did. You know, in Massachusetts, actually, they passed laws that said that if a Quaker showed up, they would be burned or burned at the stake or hung. And they actually put mostly women to death for being Quakers in Massachusetts. And so then the Quakers organized their state in Pennsylvania, you know, William Penn going down there. And then they started going after the Puritans and the Lutherans.
I understand that, and I'm sure plenty of people who listen to the station understand that.
And the founders knew that, and they said enough of these religious wars already. We're going to take religion out of the public sphere. The other thing that perhaps you don't know, Albert, is that in England, right up through the early 1800s, and in the United States, up through the middle 1700s, there were what were called maximum wage laws. And these were among the first laws that the colonies voted when they got their semi-independent legislatures through the period from the 1740s through the 1770s that they voted to do away with. But the reason why the maximum wage laws were in place, where they said it is illegal to pay a person more than $4 an hour, the reason why the maximum wage laws were in place was because the British aristocracy believed that if people like you and me had enough money that they were not scratching in the dirt, basically, for food and shelter, then they would the next thing that they would try to get once they had food and shelter under control and the necessities of life, what they called the necessaries of life back then, the next thing that they would try to acquire was political power. And so the maximum wage laws were a way to prevent a middle class from emerging, because the two times that we've had a very large and strong middle class in the United States, which is the period from 1760 to around 1800 or 1820, arguably, and the period from 1940 until 1990, or the mid-1980s, those two times were the times of greatest social ferment. I mean, the conservatives were absolutely right. A strong middle class means you have women saying, hey, wait a minute, we want an equal place in the workplace, and African Americans and other minorities saying, hey, wait a minute, what about us? And gays saying, hey, wait a minute, we're part of the family of humanity here, and et cetera, et cetera. And kids saying, hell no, I won't go, I don't like that war, or whatever. You know, people asserting themselves politically. That's what happens when you have a middle class.
And the way
you stop that from happening is you wipe out the middle class.
I know you spoke before about the old tax. I think, was it even under the Kennedy administration? You said that corporate income taxes for those making over, what, 3 million or 1 million? There was a certain, the tax rate was 91% or 80%.
It was personal income tax. If you made over $3.2 million in today's dollars during the Roosevelt administration, the Truman administration, the Eisenhower administration, and Dwight Eisenhower thought this was a fine thing, by the way, the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration, Kennedy dropped it down to 71%, from 91% down to 71%, and then Reagan came along and crashed it to 27%, and that was the beginning of the end of the middle class in the United States.
It's hard to live on 3.1 million or whatever it is. I don't know how it's done in this country.
It's really tough. And everything you earned up to 3.1 million was not taxed. So, Albert, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Your points are well made. Rick in San Luis Obispo, California. Hey, Rick, got about a minute before we got to take a break. What's up?
Okay. It seems like every time the Fed raises the interest rates to so-called stop inflation or head off inflation, they end up killing the economy.
Okay, go ahead and finish your point.
And then... After that happens, then they have to start dropping them. It takes a long time to turn things around. And we went through that cycle just recently, and no sooner did things get healthy, they started pulling the same trick again.
Yeah, and there are many who suspect that they pull these tricks based on political timing, and I wouldn't be in the least surprised. The reality is that as the Fed increases interest rates, they do that to make it more difficult for banks to loan, which slows down the rate of increase of the money supply in the United States, which then reduces inflation in theory. I mean, looking at it in an entirely monetarist point of view, but I really think you need to look at it in a larger, John Maynard Keynes is the expert on this thing. Look at it in a larger view, and look at it as the economy is a function of demand, not as a function of supply. Supply-side economics has been completely discredited, if nothing else, by history. During demand-side economics from the 40s until the 80s, we had average 6% annual growth. From the 80s to today, we've been around 3% annual growth of GDP. It just doesn't work. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. see the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war. Mortal thunder from the skies, killing everything they say they're fighting for.
1-866-303-2270, TomHartman.com for our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for the blog. Welcome back. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I got a fun little story here that illustrates your inflation and what's going on with our dollar. There's a story out there right now about an IRS case that happened in September the 16th, I believe. You can find it on the Internet. But an employer was paying his employees with junk silver, which are, you know, old circulating dollars.
Old quarters and, yeah, quarters, dimes. Dollars, half dollars, dimes, yeah.
And he was paying his employees with this, and therefore their wages were so low that they didn't require to be reported for income tax.
Oh, in other words, he was paying them at silver value, not at face value.
At face value. He was paying.
Oh, at face value.
He was paying. Face value is what they reported. And
So in other words, here, for our listeners who don't understand what we're talking about, right now, if you gave me $100 worth of silver quarters, you know, that 400 silver quarters worth $100 at face value, I could put them in vending machines and get $400 worth of stuff, or get $100 worth of stuff out of it. The silver in those $100 worth of quarters is worth what? Probably $500-$600 bucks? About $1,000. Okay, so that's $1,000 worth of silver. So, because it's U.S. currency,
correct.
If I go into a bank and I give them one of those silver quarters, they will say, okay, we're going to credit 25 cents to your account, even though it's worth, you know, a whole lot more than that. It's worth about 10 times more than that. It's worth about $2.50. So this guy is saying, my employees are willing to work for me for 25 cents an hour, or for, you know, a dollar an hour, let's say, and he pays them with four quarters, and that's really worth $10. And the IRS is, so what was the IRS's position on this?
They had 161 counts against them for conspiracy, for tax evasion, et cetera. And they were saying that they were trying to say that, no, the junk silver was worth much more. The employees were getting that they wanted to tax them on the intrinsic value of the silver. And he had Supreme Court cases in his favor, and he won. The jury came back not guilty.
Wow.
Yeah, so, and they buried this story because they don't want a lot of folks to know this, but if you were to get paid for anything in junk silver, the reporting on it would be the face value.
Huh! That's, there've got to be a couple of small business people out there going, ho-ho!
That's why the story's not circulating much more in the mainstream media, but it is out there on the net. I've sent you a copy in your email. You might want to take a look for it. It's a fun story.
Okay, Dave, thank you very much. That's amazing. And again, you know, the usual caveat, just because somebody said it on the radio, or just for that matter, just because you found it on the internet, doesn't mean it's true. So, you know, double check things. Amazing. Michael in Los Angeles. Hey, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's up?
You were mentioning earlier monetary policy, and it's easy to overlook that energy policy really is the essence of our economy and our monetary system. I mean,
it certainly has been since about 1900.
As an example, if you take the California, you know, meltdown and rolling blackouts of the late 90s, it's a model that illustrates it takes a 2x4 to the kneecap of Friedman economics. Enron used deregulation to create bucket shops in electrons that they traded among themselves to run up the price of electricity. California power plants opened and closed their operations at pivotal points to make sure to keep the prices of energy up. California legislature prohibited the introduction of new power plants because it would destroy, quotes, the profit motive, which eliminated any competition. California consumers were left with paying for the conduits, such as the, you know, the terminals that bring power to their industries or their homes or what have you.
Right, and, the infrastructure.
I mean, every area, you name it, foreign policy, GDP, environment, monetary, role of government, taxes, price shock, which is the illustration of Naomi Klein's book carried out by accountants, electricity is there. And I think the best way to really illustrate the failure of these fake capitalists is to begin with energy policy and work your way back.
Michael, a question. You live in California. I have not kept my finger on this. It was reported that, and I think fairly solidly, that Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he was merely a movie star, met with Ken Lay, as I recall, it was at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
I may be wrong.
And, before the rolling blackouts began and before the Impeach Gray Davis campaign was undertaken by Daryl Issa. And has he ever, to this day, explained what he was doing in that meeting with Ken Lay?
Well, no, but the best people could come up with is he remains a sleeper cell for the far right wing. But, you know, going back to even to this day, you know, energy policy, whether it be electrical, alternative, fossil, you name it, there's nothing that tracks the volatility of Treasury securities the way energy stocks do.
Oh, that's interesting. So energy stocks are up then, presumably, right now.
Well,
yeah, of course, you know, ExxonMobil. I mean, they're making a fortune.
Well, yeah, but it also depends on, you know, you can construct any kind of economy you want, but, you know, energy is the true, you know, measurement of who's producing what.
And it's the true currency of our world right now.
Absolutely.
I mean, and that's and in fact, that's why it's we're working so desperately to make sure that the dollar is the international medium of exchange for oil.
Blackout.
Yeah, exactly. Michael, thank you very much. It's a cogent point. Well made. Coming up tomorrow, Peter Phillips from Project Censored is here. ProjectCensored.org to talk about why the U.S. lacks a full healthcare system and the upcoming Project Censored event. I won first prize, or I'm sharing first prize with another author. Christy Harvey's dropping by from the Center for American Progress. That and your calls and the best of the rest of the news. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.